All right, well, Anarchism, I'm sure we can all recognise with its, you know, rebellious rhetoric, its Sex Pistols songs, and its, you know, enthusiastic wearing of black, can certainly seem like the most radical thing going around. And I think especially to the extent that, you know, Marxism or socialism is associated in people's minds either with, you know, Stalinism or with the kind of reformist social democracy, the likes of our stale old conservative Labour Party, well, anarchism, you know, can certainly appeal, obviously, to people who want radical change. The reality, though, as I'll argue, is that anarchism does not have any kind of strategy which can actually overthrow capitalism or abolish the state or, for that matter, destroy hierarchical authority. Anarchist theory, even in its best incarnation as anarcho-syndicalism or, you know, sometimes called libertarian socialism, ends up basically rejecting the only force which can actually end this system, which is workers' revolution and the taking of workers' power. Anarchism's abstract and classless opposition to all authority ends up meaning the anarchists also oppose the revolutionary authority of the oppressed and exploited. And the ultimate proof of all this, I think, is that in every serious struggle, anarchist principles are either, you know, abandoned by anarchists or lead to defeat, or normally a bit of both. Okay, well, where to begin? Because obviously there's lots of different types of anarchists. And I'm not going to spend too much time talking about the, you know, the most, you know, prevalent kind of anarchists around today. This is how Murray Bookchin, who is himself an anarchist, described the dominant current of anarchism today. He said, "The 1990s are awash in self-styled anarchists who, their flamboyant radical rhetoric aside, are cultivating a latter-day anarchist individualism that I will call lifestyle anarchism. Ad hoc adventurism, personal bravado, and aversion to theory, oddly akin to the anti-rational biases of postmodernism, celebrations of theoretical incoherence or pluralism, are basically apolitical and anti-organizational commitment to imagination, desire, and ecstasy, and an intensely self-oriented enchantment of everyday life." So that is an actual anarchist talking about the kind of predominant currents of anarchism today. And you know, obviously we can say, you know, a lot about the kind of lifestyle anarchists, that they've, you know, given up on the fight against capitalism to such an extent, really, that they just seek today, you know, an individual lifestyle which they can see to be, you know, outside the system, you know, and they tend to quite insultingly, I think, mimic the actions of the desperately poor, you know, so things like, you know, squatting, dumpster diving, and so on. So I'm not going to talk too much more about that. I think we can clearly see they pose no real challenge to, you know, exploitation, to the way that capitalism orients, works today. The other most visible form of anarchism today is seen in people, you know, like the Black Bloc protesters of Europe, or you know, we had our own version of that here in Australia, the G20 protest, the Arterial Bloc, the people who, you know, organise particular blocs within demonstrations, who, you know, generally have an utterly elitist attitude to the mass of protesters and to the mass of the working class in general, and they're very much in the kind of, you know, what I call the V for Vendetta style anarchists of, you know, the actions of the individual or small groups of individual heroes are needed to kind of, drill the stupid masses out of their passivity. And so, you know, we see all the kind of attacks on the symbols of capitalism is what characterizes these movements without, you know, doing anything to build the kind of mass movements which can actually challenge capitalism today. And, you know, but I think to understand, you know, this form of anarchism today, as well as the lifestyleism, we really need to go back to the beginnings, to the beginning of the story, and to look more at anarchist theory in general. In particular, the anarchist arguments about authority and the state, and, you know, and to look at a bit more at the historical points when anarchism has been a more serious force. Okay, well, to start with, I want to look at the, you know, the long-running anarchist myth that Marxists are all a bunch of authoritarian lovers of the state. And this myth, of course, goes right back to the founding figures of anarchism, Proudhon and Bakunin. This is what Bakunin argued. He said, they, you know, talking about Marx and Engels and their followers, are worshippers of state power and necessarily also prophets of political and social discipline and champions of order established from the top downwards. They are for government. We, for our part, are anarchists. Okay, and anarchists have been repeating this kind of nonsense ever since. And now, these days, of course, they point to the defeat of the Russian Revolution and Stalinism as somehow proving this claim. I don't really have time to talk about all the arguments about the Russian Revolution. If anyone was at the, had been to our other sessions over Marxism or was at the debate yesterday with Adrian Jones, it pretty much suffices to say that the anarchists just repeat all the same arguments as the right-wing, you know, Western ruling class historians here, that basically Lenin inevitably led to Stalin, and, you know, that pretty much ignore the isolation of the revolution and everything else, just like the right-wing historians in general do. In fact, though, the anarchists tend to take this one step further. It's not just that Lenin led to Stalin, it's that Marx inevitably leads to Stalin. Marxism inevitably leads to this kind of Stalinism. And so one anarchist biographer of Proudhon wrote that Marxism has given us societies in which the state has become the instrument of a bureaucratic tyranny. This is precisely what Proudhon said would happen if Marx's ideas were given practical force and expression. The moral flaw in Marxism derives from the fact that Marx inherited his master Hegel's conviction that the state is a being superior not only to each individual, but to the sum of all the individuals composing a society. This conviction has inevitably made the Marxist state into a devouring monster. Okay. Well, I'll come back a bit later to what Marx actually said about the state, but this basic kind of, you know, slander that Marxism equals, you know, tyrannical state socialism, whereas anarchism equals freedom and libertarian socialism, is the common starting point for pretty much all anarchists. Okay, so what about these great lovers of liberty, Proudhon and Bakunin? record leaves a lot to be desired. Proudhon and Bakunin actually held views which were incredibly reactionary and, you know, incredibly authoritarian as well. As Proudhon put it, democracy disgusts me. He opposed strikes. He actually supported the police breaking strikes up. He opposed working class revolution. As a member of the French Legislative Assembly in the revolutionary year of 1848, he actually supported the crushing of the June uprising of Parisian workers. And he later supported the presidential candidacy of General Cavaignac, I hope you say it, who was the man actually responsible for violently putting down the June uprising. Later, Proudhon also wrote a pamphlet in support of one of the Napoleon dictators. He was an apologist for Russian Tsarism, and he was an out-and-out racist who justified slavery on the grounds that blacks were inferior to Europeans. And he actually used anarchist kind of arguments for federalism to defend the slave-owning South during the American Civil War. And he was a total French nationalist, and he was a really extreme kind of misogynist and a sexist. Man's primary condition, he wrote, is to dominate his wife and be the master. Okay. Now, Bakunin, for his part, who, you know, the more kind of radical anarchist definitely looked to more than Proudhon, was himself, you know, totally, you know, anti-German. He was a virulent anti-Semite. He was a conspiracy theorist. And as Paul D'Amato puts it, he was an advocate of methods so authoritarian as to make a Stalinist blush. he goes on to say, most secret societies in Europe at least had the merit of focusing their organizing efforts against the despotic rulers of Europe, not Bakunin. Because Bakunin and his followers actually devoted all of their time and energies to trying to undermine and take over the International Working Men's Association, which Marx had been one of the key figures in founding. And they didn't try and take it over with, you know, open debate, you know, and democratic debate and so on, but actually, you know, through basically just racist anti-Jewish slander against Marx and the forming of a secret alliance, as Bakunin called it, inside the International. So instead of, yeah, the open democratic procedures of the International, which Marx argued for, Bakunin thought that, you know, any kind of spontaneous revolutionary action of the masses had to be supplemented by the invisible direction of a handful of self-selected revolutionaries. And this was Bakunin's own secret alliance. So as Bakunin argued, this is, you know, the great libertarian, Bakunin argued that for the very establishment of the triumph of revolution over reaction, the unity of revolutionary thought and action must find an agent in the thick of the popular anarchy. That agent must be the secret universal association of international brothers. He then goes on to argue that this secret society will become a kind of revolutionary general staff that need only consist of a small group. And so he wrote, 100 powerfully and seriously allied revolutionaries are enough for the international organization of the whole of Europe. He wrote, like invisible pilots in the thick of popular tempest, we must steer the revolution not by any open power, but by the collective dictatorship of all the allies, 100 of them, a dictatorship without insignia, titles, or official rights, and all the stronger for having none of the paraphernalia of power. Okay, so obviously, you know, who is the real authoritarian in this picture? Is it Marx, who, you know, argued for the dictatorship of the proletariat, a dictatorship of the whole of the working class, or is it Bakunin, who, yeah, plotted for the secret and therefore totally unaccountable dictatorship of a tiny handful of self-selected initiates? Okay, now, these kind of ideas of Bakunin were not completely uncommon at the time. That pretty much all of the socialists around the time of the 19th century before Marx and Engels pretty much, you know, saw the mass of the working class purely as being, you know, the most kind of suffering class in society. They didn't see that the workers had the agency to actually change the world, and instead all thought that you needed a kind of, you know, small elite group of you know, people to basically make revolution and make socialism on behalf of the masses. And this clearly we can see is a tradition that anarchism didn't particularly break from. And added to this, anarchism kind of tacks on the you know, kind of bourgeois liberalism of Adam Smith, really. You know, the kind of anti-statism of you know, of Adam Smith was one that said, well, we shouldn't have a state so we can have better kind of private capitalism and so on. But I might come back to some of those arguments later. But I think the key thing to also recognise now is that, well, Marx broke from all of these ideas at the time, and he instead argued, you know, for example, as rule one of the international that he was a part of, that the emancipation of the working classes must be conquered by the working classes themselves. Okay, now, obviously many anarchists today, you know, who know about Bakunin's history and everything, generally try to distance themselves, you know, from Bakunin and Proudhon's excesses or whatever. But I think we've got to see that Bakunin's practice was not just some aberration. It was actually the admission of a fundamental weakness or a few fundamental weaknesses within anarchism, which I'll go through. Okay, firstly, what about this whole principle of anti-authoritarianism? Well, anarchists argue that if we want to create a world without hierarchy and authority, then we have to organise all our struggles today in a way which also you know, do away with hierarchy and authority. So Murray Bookchin again argues that there can be no separation of the revolutionary process from the revolutionary goal. A society based on self-administration must be achieved by means of self-administration, as he puts it. A more recent version of this, Jura Books in Sydney, argues that if we wish to enact change, we must implement that change in our daily behaviours. So I think we can clearly see the kind of slippery slope here into lifestyle politics, and, you know, particularly associated with the environment movement normally today. But for many anarchists following from Bakunin, this also means basically opposing democratic organising principles, because, you know, democracy implies the authority of the majority over the minority. And it also means opposing you know, leadership, and particularly any kind of formalised leadership bodies, even when they're elected, as these supposedly are just another authoritarian hierarchy. And so we can clearly see the link between anti-authoritarianism and just plain old individualism. Freedom, wrote Bakunin, is the absolute right of every human being to seek no other sanction for his actions but his own conscience, to determine these actions solely by his own will, and consequently to owe his first responsibility to himself alone. So, yeah, and obviously there's nothing radical at all about this argument. You know, it's the kind of thing plenty of the Tea Party is saying today to oppose any form of healthcare or anything like that, or, you know, public healthcare. Okay, along with this, you know, the anarchists imagine that they can kind of wish away leadership itself. And this is something I'll come back to. But clearly we can see that leadership exists in every struggle. You know, it can be different forms of leadership, can be have different politics to it and everything like that. But every strike, every workplace, you know, every form of struggle contains some form of leadership. And this is just, to recognize this is just to recognize that within the working class, within any kind of struggle, there is an uneven consciousness. You know, as people have different ideas, different levels of confidence and of, you know, understanding of the needs of the struggle and so on. And Marxists will seek to democratize that leadership, to make it democratically accountable, whereas anarchists try to kind of wish it away. As Hal Draper puts it, he says, of all ideologies, anarchism is the one most fundamentally anti-democratic in principle, since it is not only unalterably hostile to democracy in general, but particularly to any socialist democracy, even of the most ideal kind that could be imagined. In rejecting all authority, even with consent, he argues, it upholds the right of a small minority to impose its conception on the large majority, if necessary by violence. Okay, but in rejecting, formal democratic organizing, you know, majority decision making, elected leadership bodies, and so on, anarchists, of course, do not magically do away with leadership, authority, and hierarchy. They just make it unaccountable and free from democratic control. And so Joe Freeman, who was an activist in the women's liberation movement in the 1970s, basically summed up this process. To strive for a structureless or laissez-faire group is about as realistic as a laissez-faire society. The idea becomes a smokescreen for the strong or the lucky to establish unquestioned hegemony over others. This hegemony can easily be established because the idea of structurelessness does not prevent the formation of informal structures, but only formal ones. So hence, you know, Bakunin's, you know, secret societies, and so on. And so we can, you know, really see the link as well between this kind of anti-democracy and anti-leadership and the actual elitism which characterizes so many anarchist and anarchist movements. And this is kind of summed up by Emma Goldman, who was one of the most popular anarchists. She wrote that always at every period the few were the banner bearers of a great idea of liberating effort, not so the mass, the leaden weight of which does not let it move. The majority cares little for ideals or integrity. What it craves is display. It matters not whether that be a dog show, a prize fight, or a lynching. And from that flows the whole idea of the propaganda of the deed. Again, the idea of a small elite minority has to do something, you know, spectacular to drive the masses out of their lethargy and passivity. And this, you know, that leads to, you know, even things like terrorism or assassinations or so on. Okay. Now, all of this, again, just serves to highlight what I think is another real weakness in anarchism, that it's basically just an idealist approach to the world as opposed to a materialist one. This is summed up by one anarchist who writes, anarchism offers a unified and coherent way of making sense of these crises by tracing them to a common source. They're talking about, you know, the different problems of the world. This source, they argue, is the principle of hierarchical authority, which underlies the major institutions of all civilized society, whether capitalist or communist. So in other words, the source of the world's problems is not, you know, the class divide or anything like that. It's a principle of hierarchical authority. And this, of course, doesn't really explain anything, let alone where this principle of hierarchical authority came from in the first place. Now, Engels wrote, you know, a lot about this in his battles against the anarchists of his day. And he wrote in particular, you know, contrary to what the anarchists argue, authority is not something which can be just wished away or abolished by a proclamation. Actually, it flows from the material reality of production and of the way the world is organized today. So he argues that he's talking about, you know, the historical development of capitalism, and he says that everywhere, everywhere the combined action displaces independent action by individuals. And he's talking about, you know, the process of, you know, instead of small producers, capitalism creates, you know, massive workplaces, which inevitably involve some kind of authority because they necessitate the collective organization of these workplaces. He argues, you know, summing up this kind of argument, he says, you know, when I submitted arguments like these to the most rabid anti-authoritarians, the only answer they were able to give me was the following. Yes, that's true, but there it is not the case of authority which we confer on our delegates, but of a commission entrusted. These gentlemen think that when they have changed the names of things, they have changed the things themselves. This is how these profound thinkers mock at the whole world. And I think Engels really hits the nail on the head. He's talking about there can be no collective organization without some form of centralized authority, without some kind of common will. And the goal for Marxists, again, is to democratize this authority, whereas anarchists try to make it go away with word games, the better to uphold their own individual liberty. And the same thing, I think, we can see clearly applies to the struggle against capitalism, that any form of struggle which tries to challenge the way the world is run, even far short of revolution, actually is about some people trying to impose their authority on others, or one class trying to impose its authority on another. And then we can see this clearly just from any strike which takes place. You know, a strike obviously is, you know, workers organizing together to try to impose their authority on the boss. But in order to do so, actually, any effective strike needs a good picket line. And what is this? Well, this is basically some workers imposing their authority, not even directly over the boss, but over other workers. To be consistent, anarchists, of course, would have to oppose pretty much all picket lines, which they generally don't, but they can't really explain this phenomenon. I'll skip over some of that. Okay, so obviously, this is just a smaller example, but when taken to its logical conclusion, this approach becomes particularly disastrous, particularly when it's applied to the central institution of authority in society, the state. So the anarchist, idealist and kind of classless approach to the question of authority, extends to the state as well. Anarchist Camillo Benetti summed up the anarchist perspective clearly when he writes that the Marxists foresee the natural disappearance of the state as a consequence of the destruction of classes by the means of the dictatorship of the proletariat. So it's a fair summary, but he goes on, that is to say, state socialism. Whereas the anarchists desire the destruction of the classes by the means of a social revolution which eliminates with the classes the state. Okay, so for the anarchists, it seems to be just a question of desire then, that the Marxists, for some reason, just want to cling on to the state for a while, whereas the anarchists will just abolish it immediately. But the problem remains, where does the state come from? And for anarchists, the state basically is just another hierarchy to be, done away with, to be abolished. Whereas for Marx and Engels, well, they actually spent a lot of time studying the question of, what is the state, where does it arise, and what role does it play in society? And they concluded that the state was a product of the class divisions in society, and therefore, well, the state can never be destroyed until class divisions are actually completely done away with. But a revolution, of course, does not just instantly create a classless society overnight. And so a revolution cannot instantly do away with states in one fell swoop. Actually, it takes a whole process of economic transformation before classes can be done away with, even after a revolution. In addition to this, Marx argued that because the existing capitalist state is a tool, or all states are a tool of class oppression, that the working class cannot simply lay hold of the ready-made state machine and wield it for its own purposes. Instead, it must be smashed. But, a revolution which smashes the capitalist state actually has to put something else in its place if the working class is to secure its domination over the capitalists and prevent a counter-revolution. And for Marx, the whole experience of the Paris Commune of 1871 demonstrated how a new sort of power could be organized and controlled by an insurgent working class. This is a new form of power which could centralize, coordinate, and direct the forces of the revolution while at the same time being controlled democratically from below, with elected, recallable officials, with none of the privileges and top-down bureaucratic control which characterize the capitalist state. So in other words, in the course of revolution, workers need to create their own form of state, a workers' state, until classes have actually been abolished, at which point, Marx and Engels argued the state would wither away, given that there was no longer any class antagonism in society and therefore nothing for a state to do. Okay, and of course a workers' state is almost the complete opposite of the capitalist state. As Lenin argued, the exploiting classes need political rule to maintain exploitation, i.e. in the selfish interest of an insignificant minority against the vast majority of the people. The exploited classes need political rule in order to completely abolish all exploitation, i.e. in the interest of the vast majority of the people and against the insignificant minority consisting of modern slave owners, the landowners and capitalists. Okay, and yet anarchists totally reject this form of workers' power. Instead, they stick to the classless formulation that state equals authority equals bad. And the consequences of such a position as we can see, are particularly disastrous when they're actually put in practice. And I'll just talk briefly about the experience in Spain, because it's the most clear case. In Spain, well, we saw, we've got to say, pretty much the best that anarchism has to offer. Because here, in the form of the CNT, which was a mass anarchist trade union federation, and it was dominated by the leadership of the particular anarchist organizations, we saw a massive working class anarcho-syndicalist organization at the height of revolution. And, you know, masses of Spanish workers were drawn to the CNT because of its radical rhetoric, its action, and its general kind of hostility to politics, which, you know, really was a reflection of the hostility to the reformist sellouts of the socialist parties and so on in Spain. But this opposition to politics in the form of the CNT was also a rejection, basically, of a coherent strategy for the overthrow of capitalism. Now, in 1936, in Spain, the Spanish military, led by Franco, launched a nationwide coup to try to topple the Republican government and to try and crush, you know, what had been an insurgent and a rising working class and peasant rebellion in the country. And, you know, the bourgeois government did nothing to resist the coup, but not so the workers. The working class rose up, seized whatever arms they could get their hands on, and fought back Franco's forces. And the old state, the old capitalist state within the Republican zone, pretty much almost completely collapsed. All the old, you know, functionaries and the military apparatus of the state had either gone over to support Franco's side or had basically been swept away in the course of the actual workers' revolution and replaced by, you know, the new forms of power on the streets and in the workplaces, which were the workers' revolutionary committees and the workers' militias. Okay, what did the anarchists do in this situation? Well, the anarchists, as I said, the CNT was one of the biggest organizations at the time in Spain. And in Barcelona, actually, which was the capital, it was the most industrialized city, and it was also the stronghold of the CNT. It was really where they had, they dominated the city. And there, the president of the remaining government in Catalonia basically offered power to the anarchists. He invited them to a meeting, the leaders of the anarchists, and he said, "Today, you are the masters of the city and of Catalonia. You have conquered and everything is in your power. If you do not need or want me as president of Catalonia anymore, tell me now." This is the kind of stuff, you know, revolutionaries dream of, surely. if only it was that easy. Now, as I said, all the effective building blocks of a worker state were pretty much already there in Spain in embryo, in the forms of the revolutionary militias, the workers' committees that had been set up, right throughout Spain. And yet the CNT declined to take power. Opposed to all authority, to all governments, opposed to all states, the anarchists could not, in good conscience, establish a revolutionary worker state. One of the anarchist leaders, Diego Abad de Santillán, wrote, "We could have imposed our absolute will, declared the government null and void, and imposed the true power of the people in its place. But we did not believe in dictatorship when it was being exercised against us, and we did not want it when we could exercise it ourselves only at the expense of others." In other words, the anarchists rejected workers' power because, in their opinion, according to the anarchist José Peretz, there is no such thing as revolutionary power, for all power is reactionary by nature. Now, of course, you know, refusing to build a workers' state does not just mean that states are abolished. All it means, actually, is that the capitalists are free to rebuild their state. And this is exactly what happened in Spain. And Trotsky wrote brilliantly at the time. He said, "In and of itself, this self-justification that we did not seize power, not because we were unable, but because we did not wish to, because we were against every kind of dictatorship and the like, contains an irrevocable condemnation of anarchism as an utterly anti-revolutionary doctrine. To renounce the conquest of power is voluntarily to leave the power with those who wield it, the exploiters. The essence of every revolution consisted and consists in putting a new class in power, thus enabling it to realize its own program in life. It is impossible to wage war and to reject victory. It is impossible to lead the masses towards insurrection without preparing for the conquest of power." And really, this was only the beginning of the betrayals by the anarchists, because having rejected workers' power, they very quickly ended up joining the bourgeois government. And what prompted this backflip really was the the onward march of Franco's fascist armies. And because the anarchists had been completely unable to actually propose any positive alternative to the bourgeois government, any positive alternative for how you could actually defeat Franco, for how the working class could centralize its forces, could organize itself, and could actually, you know, organize the military and the economic, a new society which could actually fight off Franco, having given up on that project, the anarchists, and turned around and just capitulated to the argument of the Stalinists and the bourgeois Republican parties. The anti-fascist unity now meant the need to subordinate and wind back the workers' revolution. Okay, so what followed was, now with the active collaboration of the CNT, was the defeat first of the revolution. First of all, the vestiges of workers' power, the militias were disarmed, the workers' committees were undermined and eventually gotten rid of. And then, having defeated all the bases of workers' power, of course, Franco inevitably won the Civil War. Now, anarchists today are divided over the question of Spain, and many defend still the CNT entering the government, including Emma Goldman actually defended this position. And they basically just argue, there was no alternative. There was a civil war. Who would have thought there would be a civil war in a revolution? So, of course, we just had to jettison all of our anarchist principles and join the bourgeois government in the sake of unity. But others argue that this was a betrayal of anarchism and that the anarchists should have stayed out of the bourgeois government, that this was a huge mistake, that you can't condemn anarchism because this was just a betrayal by some anarchists of true anarchist principles. But the reality is that these people still have no positive alternative. So they can't argue, well, what should have been done? What should have actually happened in Spain to organize a kind of force which could have done away and not needed the bourgeois state anymore, gotten rid of that, but also been able to defeat Franco? And they can't present any alternative to do this because they still oppose any idea of a centralized workers' power which could have actually defeated Franco. Well, I'll begin to wind up. I think, once again, we've got to see that the inability of the anarchists, refusal of the anarchists to support workers' power does not somehow just do away with states. It does not mean that the state therefore is abolished, whereas nasty authoritarian Marxists just cling onto this thing because they want to. All it means really is that it leaves the gate open for the capitalists to reorganize their state and to come back and attack us. And I'll wind up with what Engels wrote. He wrote that the anti-authoritarians demand that the political state be abolished at one stroke, even before the social conditions that gave birth to it have been destroyed. They demand that the first act of the social revolution shall be the abolition of authority. Have these gentlemen ever seen a revolution? A revolution is certainly the most authoritarian thing there is. It is the act whereby one part of the population imposes its will upon the other by means of rifles, bayonets, and cannon. Authoritarian means, if such there be at all. And he goes on to argue, well, therefore, either one of two things. Either the anti-authoritarians don't know what they're talking about, in which case they are creating nothing but confusion, or they do know, and in that case they are betraying the movement of the proletariat. And in either case, they serve the reaction. So, and just incidentally, there's going to be another session on syndicalism later in the day. So I have, people should go to that if they want to find out more about the syndicalists. But I really think that anyone who wants to see radical change in the world today actually needs to be won to the politics of working class revolution. And that actually means the project of workers organizing themselves to rise up and take power. Not just kind of economic power in the factories, but also political power and state power, as this is the necessary precondition to actually ending exploitation and to ending states altogether. And this means really rejecting the anarchist politics of elitism, of anti-democratic individualism, and the need to adopt revolutionary Marxism. And also, we've got to say, to try to build a socialist party which actually fights for these ideas in the working class, but organises also the kind of struggle which can actually win.